1800s, it was about 3 million. Mamluk sultanish behavior persisted into the modern era. Gamal Abdel Nasser ruled Egypt from 1952 to 1970, and his political slogan said everything that can be said about centralization. We are all Nasser. He nationalized banks, insurance companies, and other major enterprises. Land ownership was limited to around 40 acres, about the size of the plot on which the average fellaheen was starving. Imports were radically reduced, and a broad program of import substitution was effected. I'll have a McGoat and a large order of papyrus fries. Mossad says of the Nasser regime, the real administration was carried out through exceptional decrees, through patron-client relationships, through appeals to individuals in power. Sounds like Enron to me. But Alan Greenspan says America's economy is doing fine, and so, to some extent, is Egypt's. Reforms and privatizations were begun by Anwar Sadat and have continued under Hosni Mubarak. Egypt's GDP grew by an average of 5.05% a year from 1997 to 2000. I had dinner with some Egyptians in the steel business. Their business talk sounded like any business talk. When they discussed the downturn in structural steel demand resulting from global recession and the September 11th attacks, they may have meant, we are all Nasser, but what they said was, we are all broke. Though considering the size of the restaurant check they picked up, they didn't really mean it. Shopkeepers, although glum about the current situation, did not seem to be in a mood of permanent despair. I spent a pleasant hour in the Khan al-Khalili Bazaar, lounging atop rolls of brilliantly striped Egyptian canvas, talking to a maker of drawstring pokes and backpacks. He was interested to hear about the L.L. Bean boat bag and how there are people called wasps in America who can't so much as send a kid and the nanny to the beach club without employing three or four of these stiff cotton sacks. I had lunch with an Egyptian who had been born in the United States. When he was in high school, in suburban Chicago, he became serious about religion and observed Ramadan with rigor. Then he went to Egypt to work as a journalist, and now, in Ramadan, he was having lunch. My sister is a Christian fundamentalist, I said. She wouldn't crash a plane into the World Trade Center, but she might land pretty hard on somebody teaching evolution in school. A lot of people don't make that connection, the Egyptian journalist from Chicago said. But the movement of Egypt's material culture into middle-class prosperity is not happening fast enough to simply turn them into us. And since I began watching American daytime television, I'm not sure I want it to. Also, a small item in the December 10, 2001 edition of the Egyptian Gazette indicates that the fatal bullseye of centralization remains pinned to the Egyptian economy. Minister of Planning Othman Mohammed Othman, the item read, said the government was unable to manage the economy alone. In addition, Egypt continues to suffer from the corruption that's bred when profit lies down with politics. Transparency International's 2001 Corruption Perceptions Index rates Egypt 3.6 on a scale of 10, with 10 being the least corrupt. Finland is 9.9. Drug lord beleaguered Colombia at 3.8 is less corrupt than Egypt. 5 millennia of economic tomfoolery is bound to leave Egyptians confused about economic principles. On the subject of free trade, M. Ali Ibrahim, who writes the front page Tell Me More column for the Egyptian Gazette, can sound like Pat Buchanan on a bad chest hair day. Immediate restrictions must be introduced to drastically reduce imports, Ibrahim wrote on December 5, 2001. We waste millions of dollars on provocative imported commodities, dog food, nuts, and ice cream. Ibrahim cited the work of Mahmoud Bazara, an economics expert, who claims that a liberal economy doesn't mean opening wide the doors for imports. A few days later, Ibrahim's column was titled, Tell Me More, about imported prayer beads, how they're bankrupting local merchants. In the United States, I said to Peter, we're worried about Egyptian Islamic extremism. So what's with all the crosses on the Cairo skyline? I'm Christian, Peter said, The owners of his tour company were also Christians, as were most of its employees.
How many Egyptians are Christian? I asked.
Many, said Peter, but I don't know how many. Most Egyptian Christians are members of the Coptic Church. Fawad Ajami writes, "The demographic weight of the Copts is one of the great riddles of Egypt." Ajami quotes the political historian Rifat Said, who says, "We count everything in Egypt. Cups, shoes, books. The only thing we don't count are the Copts." Copts make up 6% of the Egyptian population, the official estimate, or 10%, the historian Afaf Marsot's estimate, or 12%, the estimate from the American organization Center for Religious Freedom in Washington, D.C. Only 11% of Swedes go to church. Egypt may be a more Christian country than Sweden. Copts believe that the nature of Jesus Christ was completely divine. Other Christians believe that the nature of Jesus was both divine and human. This used to be something you could get killed over, and it still is. Muslims believe that the nature of Jesus was just plain human. Islamic extremist violence has been aimed at fellow Egyptians as well as at foreign tourists. In January 2000, in the town of El Kusha, anti-Copt rioting resulted in the deaths of 22 Christians. But Afaf Marsot claims that the Copts were treated better by their Muslim conquerors than by their Byzantine overlords, who considered them heretics. Copts were incorporated into the Arab government. Bernard Lewis says that as late as the 13th and 14th centuries, Muslims were complaining that Copts were running the administration. They're still there. Boutros Boutros Ghali, a Copt, was Mubarak's deputy prime minister for foreign affairs before becoming secretary general of the UN. Peter took me to the Coptic quarter of Cairo. We saw a welter of Christian worship going on, although it was a weekday, and more than a few Santa decorations. Peter showed me where Pharaoh's daughter found Moses floating in a basket. The basement grotto was flooded, so this may have been the spot. No, I'm getting mixed up in my notes. The flooded grotto was the place where Jesus and Mary and Joseph, when Herod the Great was killing all those babies, sought shelter on their flight into Egypt. I hope they brought galoshes. The Church of St. Sergius, one of the oldest Christian churches in Egypt, was constructed over the grotto in the 5th century. To support one end of a door lintel in the church, a Roman column was used with its capital flat on the floor, in case you think it's only Muslims who turn civilization upside down. The place where Moses was found is in the Ben Ezra Synagogue, which is no longer used for daily worship. Fewer than 100 Jews are left in Egypt, Peter said. All of them are over 70. There are maybe 20 synagogues in Egypt. Only one is open. When Ben Ezra was restored in the 19th century, thousands of manuscripts were discovered dating back to the 11th century. It is the habit of the Jews all over the world, Peter said, to write the story of their lives and hide these writings in certain places. I was thinking of Anne Frank, but I don't believe Peter was. He talked about the closed society of the Jews and said, "We do not forget the help the Jews gave the Hyksos." These were the pharaohs of the 15th dynasty, apparently of Semitic origin, who ruled Egypt after the fall of the Middle Kingdom, 3,650 years ago. Peter was still irked. "The Jews came to Egypt three times," he said, frowning, "with Joseph, with Ptolemy, and in 1492. And with baby Jesus in A.D. 1. By the way, the Jews were moderately well-treated on each occasion, although there seems to have been a flare-up of ill-feeling about the time of the Exodus, and now, of course. In December 2001, the big hit from Egypt's pop singer of the moment, Shaban Abdel Rahim, was "Ana Bakra Israel," I Hate Israel. Abdel Rahim claimed the cassette had sold 5 million copies. In a week's worth of Egyptian gazettes, each edition only 8 to 12 pages long, I counted 58 articles involving Israel. The December 12, 2001 issue alone had 5, 3 of them on the front page. One piece, on December 10th, cited, "Rumors that Mossad agents have secretly hidden magnetic strips inside Cleopatra cigarettes." The story noted that strong electromagnetic fields are a health risk, and went on to mention lethal magnetic belt buckles seen as an Israeli plot to make Egyptians sterile.
The Egyptian Gazette, which the Lonely Planet Guide calls Egypt's awful daily English language newspaper, is an anodyne and anti-Osama publication that turns up outside hotel room doors in the morning and is clearly meant to be read by foreigners, some of whom are likely to be Jewish. Much worse things are available from the Arab language press, as is pointed out by the Middle East Media Research Institute, Memory, a pro-Israel organization that collects much worse things from the Arabic language press. According to Memory, the following items appeared in the Egyptian government dailies Al-Akhbar and Al-Ahram from April to August 2001. Mahmoud Mohammed Khater, a cleric from Cairo's Al-Azhar University, posed the rhetorical question, did Hitler attack the Jews, or did their crime deserve even more? The Zionists were a fifth column in Germany, and they betrayed the country that hosted them. Dr. Mahmoud al-Said al-Kurdi stated, the Talmud, the second holiest book for the Jews, determines that the matzahs of Atonement Day must be kneaded with blood from a non-Jew. The preference is for the blood of youths after raping them. And journalist Fahmi Hawaidi described his feelings after a suicide bombing. I cannot hide my happiness about the martyrdom operation that took place in Jerusalem last Thursday. I won't deny that it liberated me from the sorrow and misery that have overtaken me over the past weeks. Fawad Ajami's Narcotic of Anti-Zionism packs a punch. And maybe so does poetic license. I mentioned that Al-Qaeda may have a Yeats. It may have worse than that. In the Dream Palace of the Arabs, Ajami explains that Arab society puts a great value on poetic expression. A 1950s Smith College girl with her head in the oven value. In the March 10, 2002 New York Times Book Review, Judith Shulevitz wrote about Osama bin Laden's recitation of poetry on one of his videotapes, a poem plagiarized from Jordanian poet Yusuf Abu Hilala. Shulevitz said that this recitation would burnish bin Laden's reputation in a way that Americans might not readily understand, given the high premium placed in the Middle East on poetic eloquence, even in a political leader. And it is hard to imagine George W. Bush cribbing from Sylvia Plath in his post-September 11th address to the joint session of Congress. Out of the ash I rise with my red hair, and I eat men like air. Ajami quotes the poet Nizar Kabani, who said that the Arab is the quintessential poetic being, and that poetry is written on the forehead of every Arab. Anyone who has had a similar experience of letting his words get ahead of his frontal lobes knows where this can lead. Maybe, in the calumnies of Al-Akhbar, there is a kinship to Plath's poem Daddy, in which she addressed her father, Panzer man, oh you. Otto Plath was a Boston University professor of biology and an expert on bees. Or maybe what we're hearing in Al-Akhbar is prosaic hate. But either way, the reality was that it had been almost 30 years since the last war between Egypt and Israel. Americans in my parents' generation were pretty mad at the Japs. They got over it, and by the 1970s they were driving Datsuns. I flew to Luxor. Trying to understand a culture by being a tourist is famously useless, but trying to understand Egypt without being a tourist would be worse than useless. Egypt is the cradle of tourism. Herodotus was a tourist here in the 5th century BC, and the first dynasty of the pharaohs was as far removed in time from Herodotus as he is from us. Tourism was the source of history's original failure of cultural understanding. Cyril Aldred writes that ancient Greek and Roman vacationers in Egypt never really understood Egyptian religion and were inclined to see in inexplicable acts and beliefs a more profound significance than actually existed. Thus, the concept of the inscrutable Orient, the idea of the mysterious East. Luxor is the site of the ancient sacred city of Thebes, 419 miles upstream from Cairo. The Temple of Luxor is downtown, and nearby are the Colossi of Memnon, Karnak Temple, Hatshepsut's Temple, the Valley of the Kings, the Valley of the Queens, and the Ramesseum, with the gigantic shattered statue of Ramesses II that inspired Shelley to write Ozymandias. And on the pedestal these words appear, My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck other than ticket booths, soda pop stands, souvenir stalls, dozing guards, and 200 men in jalabiyas asking, "Where are you from? You buy postcard, okay?" At the Sheraton Hotel in Luxor, a few tourists were braving the geopolitics. Some Europeans, a couple of Japanese, and a scattering of dotty American retirees of the type who can't get along without L.L. Bean boat bags. I heard a voice in the Sheraton bar saying, with a plummy English accent, "The reason I got fired..." My guide in Luxor, Ibrahim, was one of those people, rare among tour guides, who are impelled to tell the truth. His description of the mummification process was sickening. I asked Ibrahim about the war on terror. "Egyptians support America's actions in Afghanistan," he said, and paused. "Most do. But I must tell you the truth, others do not. Maybe 30% do. I am Christian. All Christians support America's actions." He paused again. "But maybe 90% of Egyptians are opposed." Luxor's tombs and temples were interesting. Briefly, Ibrahim would recount the attributes, the ancestry, and the avatars of every mythological figure portrayed. He came to a brief, embarrassed halt only at Min, who is represented with a healthy erection. And so Min might well be represented, given the lissom and unburkered female deities on the tomb and temple walls. The ancient Egyptian pantheon seems to have read the Amazon.com bestseller "Look Great Naked" in an earlier edition. But the mild thrill of anachronistic eroticism wears off. The gimmick of puppy-headed gods palls, and a satiety with ritual mumbo-jumbo sets in. Too much Egyptian art in a day produces moods that go rapidly from hobbit-jaded to child-wizard-bored to the feeling of being in a vegetarian restaurant with a blind date who's talking feng shui. Ibrahim took me to just such a restaurant near the Valley of the Kings, although it became vegetarian for me, only after Ibrahim suggested I look in the kitchen. From the restaurant's terrace, I could also look up and down the Nile. The land of Egypt is nearly 700 miles long, and for most of that distance, effectively about 7 miles wide. How did this affect a culture? Did people try to make their lives long and narrow? The funerary monuments around Luxor are a huge Pharaonic Keo plan meant to fund an eternal hereafter just like the there before. I could be wrong. What will be left of our civilization 5,000 years hence? Probably the ruins of our interstate highway system. The tourists of some future age will wonder, as I wondered at the Valley of the Kings, why were these people so obsessed with where they were going instead of where they were? But our rest stops won't present the same opportunities for looting. A New Jersey devil snow globe! All the ancient Egyptian tombs were robbed, many by contemporaries of the deceased. Even the famed trove of Tutankhamun was picked over not long after it was sealed. Suspicions arise of an inside job. A pharaoh's kids had motive, means, and opportunity. They had been bilked of their inheritance, knew where the tomb was, and were paying the salaries of the guards. Didn't Grandpa have a set of solid gold dinner plates just like this? Finish your papyrus fries. Nowadays, the tombs are well protected, and so are their visitors. After the 1997 terrorist attack at Hatshepsut's temple, the corps of black-clad elite tourist police was expanded and given special training. I saw one of them sitting in a squad car with a Furby hanging from the rearview mirror. The tourist police were present in force at the Karnak Temple Complex. Karnak covers almost as much ground as Disneyland. The great hypostyle hall alone has space enough for a heck of an ancient Egyptian adventure ride, whizzing among the 134 gigantic stone pillars. Indeed, visitors once came to Karnak with a more Disney-fied attitude. In tintypes of 19th-century tourists, we see that there's room for 100 men to stand on the capital of one of these columns. This was the kind of culturally insensitive thing tourists used to do. Now they're herded into sound and light shows. The Karnak Son et Lumière began with Wagnerian music and male and female recorded voices bouncing back and forth between widely separated speakers in the manner of sound effects records from the early days of stereo. I forget what the female voice was pretending to be. The male voice was Amon-Ra, a Middle Kingdom syncretism of Ra, the sun deity, and a local goose god, the great Cackler, who laid the cosmic egg. The language of the performance was as poetic as anything that bin Laden was snapping his fingers to in the coffee houses of the Shaikot Valley. "I am Amon-Ra," said the male voice. "The waters of the Nile sprout from my sandals." The Lumiere part consisted mostly of plunging us into darkness while we hung around in these supposedly spiritual ruins. Some of the tourists took flash photos of the opacity. "Yes, definitely spirits," I heard one woman tourist say. A Ramadan service was being broadcast over the loudspeaker of a mosque outside the Karnak walls. The Son et Lumiere producers turned up their volume. The Muslim clerics turned up theirs. The producers responded in kind, so did the clerics. If the pious Muslims had had Ibrahim translating the Son et Lumiere into Arabic, there might have been more than a war of words. "I am the father of fathers, mother of mothers," announced Amon-Ra very loudly indeed. "The salvation of Amon, the salvation of Ra, also the salvation of the crocodile, offered equally to all the compass points of earth and to you, new pilgrim to Thebes." I was reminded of nothing so much as my dad in a fez headed out for a night with the boys. Dad was a 32nd degree Freemason and a member of the ancient Egyptian Arabic order of nobles of the Mystic Shrine. It's hard to imagine a worse case of cultural misunderstanding than the cultures of Egypt and Arabia represented by Dad on a midget motorcycle in the 4th of July parade. Or maybe Dad knew more than I thought. During the late 19th century, Egypt's King Tawfiq was a member of a Masonic lodge, as were many of Egypt's reform-minded liberal elite. The next night I visited the temple of Luxor, mercifully in silence. Luxor was consecrated to the Theban triad, Amon-Ra, his earth mother consort Mut, and their moon god kid Khonsu. The temple was constructed about 1300 BC and restored by Alexander the Great, who built a new sanctuary for Amon-Ra. "In the wrong place," said Ibrahim. "Properly, it should be in the last room of the temple, not here in the antechamber." Alexander's sanctuary stands just inside the antechamber's original walls. One set of hieroglyphs and reliefs was carved 1,000 years later than the other. "You see the difference?" said Ibrahim. I didn't. There is a supposed dynamism to ancient Egyptian art, according to Cyril Aldred. It is often possible for the expert to date a specimen to within a few years by its stylistic features alone. So the expert says. But the ancient Egyptian language, Aldred himself points out, has no genuine active tense. He notes that the ancient Egyptians did not adjust their calendar with the addition of an extra day every 4 years. They just let it slide for a millennium and a half until it got back into phase. When it came to art, I think the ancient Egyptians had a look going and decided to hang with it for 3,000 years. "Notice how the quality of decoration degenerated," Ibrahim said. "An important part of cultural understanding is to understand that not all cultures progress." Ibrahim and I went across the street and had dinner at McDonald's, where the quality of decoration had degenerated much further. 6. Nobel Sentiments. To mark the December 2001 100th anniversary of the Nobel Prize, Francis Crick, Nadine Gordimer, and José Saramago, in consultation with an extensive group of Nobel Prize winners, as the press release put it, issued a call to do something. The statement was signed by 103 Nobel laureates. It is printed in full below, with parenthetical exegesis by someone too dumb to ever get a Nobel, or even a MacArthur Genius Grant. "The most profound danger to world peace in the coming years will stem not from the irrational acts of states or individuals, but from the legitimate demands of the world's dispossessed. According to Nobel Statement Coordinator John C. Polanyi, Chemistry Prize 1986, the laureate's pronouncement was written before September 11th. Don't rely on tips from Nobel laureates to win the Super Bowl office pool. And irrational is an interesting word choice. Aren't Nobel Prize winners supposed to understand how rationalization works? Maybe they mean bad. Of these poor and disenfranchised, why do political bien passants roll dispossessed, poor, and disenfranchised together as if they have a natural correlation like ice, cold, and beer? The Dalai Lama, Peace Prize, 1989, is dispossessed. Your parish priest is poor. And Alan Greenspan, as a resident of the District of Columbia, is ineligible to vote in congressional elections. The majority live a marginal existence in equatorial climates. Global warming, not of their making but originating with the wealthy few, will affect their fragile ecologies most. Did you see global warming coming out of left field? Anyway, blaming the onset of Earth is Toast on the wealthy few seems a tad unscientific for a document that is signed by 65 recipients of Nobels in chemistry and physics. The Earth had temperature cycles when the wealthy few were lucky trilobites with extra rich muck to delve in. And how are we going to solve the problems of those who live a marginal existence in equatorial climates, such as that of Washington, D.C., if we don't produce more of the industrial prosperity that boils their weather? It's going to take a bunch of Nobel laureates to figure that out. Or not. Their situation will be desperate and manifestly unjust. Nice verb tense. In Congo, Haiti, Cambodia, and Liberia, their situation right now is... It cannot be expected, therefore, that in all cases they will be content to await the beneficence of the rich. I won't make a wisecrack about cannot be expected to await the beneficence of the rich. Specifically, I won't make the wisecrack and should go get a job. This would be manifestly unjust to the hard-working poor and dispossessed and disenfranchised people of the world. Besides, if they got a job, it would worsen global warming. If, then, we permit the devastating power of modern weaponry to spread through this combustible human landscape, we invite a conflagration that can engulf both rich and poor. Oh, I don't know. We did that in Afghanistan, and it was mostly the Taliban that got conflagrated. The only hope for the future lies in cooperative international action. Obviously, when it came time for war with Iraq, the cooperative international action takers at the UN weren't listening to Nobel laureates. Legitimized by democracy. Well, we're a democracy, except occasionally in Florida during electoral college vote counts. It's time to turn our backs on the unilateral search for security in which we seek to shelter behind walls. Good point. Walls collapse. On the other hand, concrete barriers that keep car bombs from being parked too close to public buildings are useful. So is baggage screening and maybe a missile shield. Instead, we must persist in the quest for united action to counter global warming and a weaponized world. Weaponize is my favorite new verb. A pen is mightier than the sword, until you weaponize your ballpoint to fight a man with a scimitar. These twin goals will constitute vital components of stability as we move towards the wider degree of social justice that alone gives hope of peace. I thought cooperative international action legitimized by democracy was the only hope. But I guess Nobel laureates, like anybody else, are entitled to change their minds. So, social justice it is. However, you'd expect Nobel laureates to do the math on this. Divide the gross domestic product of the world by the world's population, and everyone gets $7,200 a year. What kind of basketball are we going to have if Shaquille O'Neal has to take a $21,422,800 pay cut? And a family of four in Tanzania making $28,000 will buy a used Toyota, which brings us back to global warming. Some of the needed legal instruments are already at hand, such as the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the Convention on Climate Change, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaties, and the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And don't forget the Kellogg-Briand Pact, the League of Nations Charter, and the Oslo Accords. As concerned citizens, the rest of us aren't worried at all. We urge all governments to commit to these goals that constitute steps on the way to the replacement of war by law. As in the Jim Crow laws, Hitler's Nuremberg laws, South Africa's apartheid code, whatever legal jimcrackery Stalin used to prop up his show trials, etc. To survive in the world we have transformed, we must learn to think in a new way.
They said it. I didn't.
As never before, the future of each depends on the good of all.
No, the other way around. The future of all depends on the self-interested good of each. Adam Smith did a lot of work in The Wealth of Nations showing this to be the case. See Book 1, Chapter 2. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. Although Adam Smith may be a little right of center to win a Nobel. Also, he's dead. To sum up, here we have a statement beginning with a thesis that had been disproved before it was uttered, and ending with a palpable untruth. The logic meanders, the ideas are banal, the text exhibits a remarkable prolixity, considering that it's only 284 words long. Is this the best that 103 Nobel Prize winners can do? Of course, it's always tempting to make fun of the Nobels. Sidelight, Alfred Nobel owed his wealth not only to the invention of dynamite, see combustible human landscape above, but also to investment in his brother's successful exploration for oil in Azerbaijan, see combustible human landscape above. Making fun is especially tempting to those of us who will receive invitations to Stockholm only in the form of Scandinavian cruise ship brochures. Let me give in to the temptation. Ernest Hemingway, but not James Joyce. Toni Morrison, but not John Updike. Dario Fo. Selma Ottilia Lovisa Lagerlöf. She wrote The Wonderful Adventures of Niels, a fanciful account of a young boy's travels across Sweden on the back of a goose. And allow me to be the millionth person to point out that among the Nobel Peace Prize winners are Yasser Arafat, Shimon Peres, Henry Kissinger, Lee Duck Tho, and International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. If the mushroom cloud doesn't clear up, call me in the morning. For all I know, the lists of prize winners in physics, chemistry, medicine, and economics are just as whack. I'm not competent to judge. Although Cambridge University Professor Brian Josephson, Physics Prize 1973, says, there is a lot of evidence to support the existence of telepathy, and the co-discoverer of DNA, James Watson, Medicine Prize 1962, was, at age 73, researching the effects of sunshine on sex drive. Yet, let us be generous. Prize-giving of any kind is no cinch. Nobel Committee screw-ups notwithstanding, Nobel Prize winners are smarter than we are. And Nobel Prize winners are doubtless as morally alert as we are. Even the Peace Prize winners are probably, on average, decent people. I scanned the list of 100th anniversary statement signatories and didn't notice anyone in obvious need of a swift kick, the possible exception being statement co-author José Saramago, Literature Prize 1998, a Portuguese communist who wrote a novel, The Gospel According to Jesus Christ, in which Jesus tries to get out of being crucified and sleeps with Mary Magdalene. Henry Kissinger and Yasser Arafat did not apply their John Hancocks. 103 Nobel laureates have provided us with counsel on the political and social future of the world. Any such advice must be worth listening to, and I guess that includes the advice they've given us this time. But where are the words that stir men's souls, that turn their hearts, that change their minds? Where is the, we hold these truths to be self-evident? Where is even the, from each according to his ability to each according to his needs? For that matter, where's the beef? Perhaps the Nobel laureate's statement should be understood as an indictment of our age. We could be living in an era so stupid that even the most intelligent among us are cement heads. Possibly, the laureate's statement is a simple proof, if proof were needed, that nothing good ever comes out of a committee. But maybe the statement contains a deeper message. Maybe the Nobel laureates are speaking
more powerfully than they realize, for radical democratization and perfect egalitarianism. Nothing in their statement indicates that the opinions of common men are worse or more foolish than the opinions of Nobel Prize winners. Let us have our international actions truly legitimized by democracy. When it comes to questions of what is to be done, to quote Lenin as Jose Saramago might do, let's ask any old person. Let's ask Mom. Mom says, global warming or no global warming, it's cold out. Wear a hat. 7. Washington, D.C. demonstrations. April 2002. I'll keep the mohawk until we stop killing people abroad, musician Eddie Vedder quoted about his hair in the April 11, 2002 issue of Rolling Stone. The Palestinian Solidarity March had almost all the elements of a classic modern American political demonstration. On April 20th, in downtown Washington, a constituency previously not heard from, or not listened to, turned out in impressive numbers. Its representatives looked respectable. They conducted themselves with dignity. They had a grievance. The only thing missing was an intelligible demand. At least the Nobel laureates had silly ideas. The Palestinian Solidarity Marchers wanted the people of the United States to... what? Abandon one of our few allies and take up the cause of Arab regimes that hate us? And when an Arab regime, such as Saudi Arabia's, does profess friendship, it is the Eddie Haskell to our Wally Cleaver. Should we, as more than a few placards suggested, get out of the Middle East? Then the frontline Arab states could have a free hand with Israel and recapture the glories of 1949, 1956, 1967, 1973, and 1982. Are we supposed to invade the region and sort things out? We did in 1991, and we're soon to do it again. Support a Palestinian state? We've done that. Maybe we'd better continue to apply combinations of diplomatic pressure and aid incentives, keep formulating Oslo plans that settle everything in Oslo, and go on folding and refolding that darned roadmap to peace until it finally fits into the glove compartment of amity. Yet no one mounts a demonstration supporting current policies, the Million Muddlers Through March, with the masses chanting, 5, 4, 3, 2, we don't have a doggone clue. Israel stubbornly insists on existing. The foolish, despotic, and corrupt governments of the Arab countries stubbornly insist on various alternatives. The political and economic situation in Arab lands is so bad that it seems as if the only sensible thing for an Arab to do is get out and go someplace with freedom and opportunities. The people in the Palestinian Solidarity March had done so. Now they had become a successful immigrant group exercising political power, exercising it to denounce American Zionists, a successful immigrant group exercising political power. We are in the postmodern era of American political demonstrations. The Palestinian Solidarity March, an indignant crowd opposed, in a way, to itself, was marching around with little hope of achieving an objective, assuming there was one. This struck a chord. Thousands of other protesters joined in. They held a neo-demo, parodying the actions of the suffragettes, Cox's Army, the Civil Rights Movement, and the Vietnam War protests. Seeking a clear political response has been replaced by consulting a magic eight-ball of activist demands. Reply, hazy. Demonstrate again later. There were, in fact, three additional pointless marches in Washington on April 20th. The Columbia Mobilization Festival of Hope and Resistance gathered at the Washington Monument. The U.S. drug eradication policy was opposed. Millions of Americans have opposed that policy more effectively with mirrors, razor blades, and rolled-up dollar bills. The Columbia Mobilization also wanted the U.S. Army School of the Americas eliminated, although it has been and is now the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. This can no longer be called a training ground for Latin American dictators because Castro is almost the only dictator left. And to judge by the number of Che t-shirts in the crowd, the Columbia mobilization is on Castro's side. Then there was the Mobilization for Global Justice, gathered in front of World Bank headquarters. This mobilization was claiming that World Bank development policies were all wrong. A little late. One of the World Bank's own economists, William Easterly, had already published a book in 2001, The Elusive Quest for Growth, claiming that World Bank development policies were all wrong. And on the ellipse, behind the White House, the U.S. war on terrorism and Israel's West Bank incursions were being denounced by ANSWER. Act Now to Stop War and End Racism is a group that awes any fan of acronyms. I was distracted from covering their event by an urge to scribble in my reporter's notebook, trying for a one-up. Quotidian undergraduates eagerly supporting terrorist internment on Neptune. The Palestinian Solidarity March began on Connecticut Avenue at the Washington Hilton, where the somewhat acronym-impaired AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, was holding a conference. Many of the Arab Americans arrived in family groups. Mothers and daughters were modestly garbed. Men wore crisp sports shirts and creased trousers. The other protesters, not all of them young, came dressed as young protesters. Covering of hair mingled with exposing of midriff. I didn't see anyone doing both, but a number of non-Arab marchers had keffiyehs inexpertly plopped on their heads. A middle-aged man who was obviously not a Pakistani sported a shalwar kameez and walked down Connecticut eating from a box of Wheatet crackers. According to the Sunday, April 21st Washington Post, organizers at the march privately urged participants to strike swastikas from their posters. They didn't comply, but many of the protest signs had the swastikas turned backward, perhaps in an effort to soften the Nazi reference. Backward swastika equals Sharon equals backward swastika. Thus, some placards could be construed to mean American Indian decorative motif equals Prime Minister of Israel equals Hindu good luck charm. Jews were among the marchers. Jews for peace, read one sign. Jews say no to Israeli state terror, read another. A chant went up nearby. 2, 4, 6, 8, Israel is a racist state. Diverse advocacies mixed in the crowd. The rich must share. Down with corporate capitalism. Destroy all borders. And a giant cardboard turtle labeled Mobilize. Everyone got along fine. A young man carried a crude birch bark mock-up of a television captioned, "How much of your life is lived through a screen?" Another young man, a representative of something called the Independent Media Center, pedaled through the march on a bicycle equipped with a homemade duct tape and PVC pipe rig that held a video camera. Messages ranged from the disprovable, "We are all Palestinians," to the dumbfoundingly true, "Trees are not terrorists," although the day before in Washington a tree had blown over in a thunderstorm and killed a passenger in a van. Some messages conveyed no sense. "Give me freedom or give me Palestine." Some conveyed too much. "Pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli human rights in the occupied territories." Some messages were open to interpretation. A young woman carried a picture of herself smiling broadly and embracing a large, happy mutt. Written beneath was, "My dog has more rights than Palestinians." Relations between the police and protesters were cordial. When the march reached the Connecticut Avenue tunnel under DuPont Circle, some of the marchers balked at entering, not without reason. The ventilation shafts rising from the underpass into the park were unguarded stink bomb invitations. Washington Police Chief Charles Ramsey stepped in and led the way through. The Solidarity March went down 18th Street to the World Bank headquarters, where it was greeted with cheers and shouts of, "Free! Free Palestine!" There was pogo dancing at the Global Justice Rally, and bare feet and dissonant beating of drums, pots, and empty 5-gallon plastic buckets. The effect was Riverdance, if Ireland had been conquered by the deaf instead of the English. A baby carriage without a baby was pushed around with bongos and tambourines bungee-corded onto it, and a sign reading, "Rhythm Workers Union." A couple was parading on stilts carrying GROW posters. The man's beard was braided. An American flag was burned, and so was a flag with yellow, blue, and red stripes. I asked what flag it was. No one seemed to know.
Columbia? Said someone.
Two women in their 20s, festooned with buttons and stickers for various causes, ran toward the demonstrations, holding hands and uttering squeals of gleeful anticipation. I wasn't getting much information from the demonstrators. I have reached the stage in life when there's nothing I can do to keep from looking like a 50-some-year-old man who should mind his own business. I had brought along Max Pappas, who does research work for me. Max, at 26 and with a couple of days' worth of stubble, can pass for an activist of some kind, although personally, I thought the cloth cap and olive drab short-sleeved sports shirt that Max had selected to blend in made him look like a sports car enthusiast on the way to bowling league. Max spotted a pack of bouncy co-eds in yellow movement t-shirts and immediately went to interview them. They were from Colby College, and the purpose of their organization was to go to lots of demonstrations. If anyone has an idea, said one of the co-eds, you just come to the group and everyone will support you. Other collegians had an even more supportive environment. An item in the Sunday Washington Post noted, students from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and Milwaukee Area Technical College said their schools paid most of their expenses because they belonged to a campus group, Students Peace Action Network. The schools provided vans for the trip and paid for hotels. While Max was talking to the Colby co-eds, a young woman with a tape recorder thrust a microphone in my face. She had a black hanky tied across her nose. I suppose she didn't mean this as a parody of a Muslim woman's veil. Why are you at this protest? She said in a necessarily muffled voice. I'm a reporter, I said. She backed away. Max talked to a man who was carrying a placard showing rainbow stripes, a peace sign, and a suggestion to envision a world. He was walking a tiny Pomeranian that did or did not have more rights than Palestinians. Yeah, man, said the man, who appeared to be over 40. When I get older, I want to join Greenpeace. A 15-foot-wide balloon had been erected by the Rainforest Action Network. The balloon was decorated like a globe with a for sale banner across it, but it was shaped like a small town water tower, or maybe a mushroom cloud. On one side of the balloon, someone was speaking to not many people in Spanish, while a young priest with blonde streaks in his hair and wearing a fashion-forward sport coat got ready to take the mic. On the other side of the balloon was a protest against Citibank, whose Washington office is catty-corner to the World Bank. A speaker asked Citibank to finance solar mortgages. The small group of listeners chanted, though not, I gathered, as a response to the speaker's request, Hey, Citi, not with my money. Max found campus feminists to interview. One admitted that the Taliban's treatment of women was terrible and said the United States should have done something earlier in the name of women. Wouldn't that involve war? Max asked. Yeah, it's a tricky one, the feminist said. There might be some nonviolent approach, such as microlending. A man stood inside an enormous, ill-made, papier-mâché head of George Bush. The head did not bear a label. A bad portrait of George W. seemed to be the point. Other points being made in front of the World Bank. More world, less bank. Peace through peaceful means. Fuck you, CIA. No more Bhopals. Refuse war, challenge democracy. We are all Palestinians. On cartoons of Tibetan monks being beaten by Chinese soldiers and Vietnamese peasants being beaten by GIs. Keep India secular. We are complicit and stop the co-modification of water, in a crowd where almost everyone was carrying a brand-name bottle of same. There was also a placard announcing that the carrier was a representative of an organization, Suffering for African People, which critiqued the IMF's structural adjustment programs. Both protester and protestee are in dire need of acronym consultation. The mobilization for global justice smelled of cats and patchouli oil and body odor. It joined with the Palestinian Solidarity March, and everyone moved in ragtag formation along H Street and down 13th to Freedom Plaza on the far side of the White House. Counter-demonstrators were few. A Dockers-dressed mom and dad stood on H Street with their 10-year-old son. They held signs, Go Bush and U.S., Heart It or Leave It.
A few college-age protesters came out of the march to argue, though not with the parents, just with their child. Some of the marchers, though none of the Arab Americans, affected threatening attitudes. Their faces were masked, their body language was angry, they shouted, but they didn't do anything. Several hirsute and not very clean young people wore bicycle helmets and medic armbands. They hopped around nervously, giving perhaps a preview of some future socialized medicine. A kid waved an American flag that had corporate logos instead of stars on the blue field. He was wearing Adidas shoes, a Swiss Army watch, and a Mountain Smith backpack. Four of the Palestinian Solidarity marchers carried a makeshift litter bearing a girl wrapped in bandages and pretending to be injured or dead. The day was growing muggy, and the girl's companion sprinkled Evian on her face. A tourist bus got caught up in the march at 13th and New York Avenue. Someone bobbed around in the crowd wearing an enormous gold-fringed Trojan helmet. The fur hats of a group of Hasidim were almost as large. I tried to talk to them, but I couldn't get through a coterie bearing USA, Israel, Axis of Racism, White Supremacy signs. I must rely on my reportorial betters at the Washington Post. The Palestinians here in the crowd look at us mistrustfully at first, said Rabbi Yisrael Weiss, 45, of New York. But then they speak a few words with us, and they show us respect and friendship. He said his group favored dismantling Israel and returning it to the Palestinians. A sign reading, "Pro-Palestinian is not anti-Semitic," was carried next to a sign reading, "Sharon makes Hitler proud." A delegation of Iranian women in chadors was preceded by a delegation announcing, "Lesbian, gay, bi, and trans people say stop the war." One of the LGBTP was wearing, with panache, a Palestinian flag as a cape. A middle-aged Arab-American man sipped from a Starbucks cup. A college student held a placard, "Starbucks sucks." Enlarged wire service photos of Palestinian casualties were held aloft, as were "The Media Lies" posters, and one banner stated, "Cannabis smokers are not criminals." A woman ran through the march with a dollar bill dangling from the brim of her baseball cap. On her T-shirt was printed, "In Pursuit of Happiness." At the edge of Freedom Plaza, a young couple had brought their baby in a stroller and several sheets of cardboard decorated with crossed American and Israeli flags and slogans, "Support Israel" and "U.S. and Israel, Brothers United." "You can't just do nothing," the husband said. Arab Americans politely ignored them. The rest of the protesters steered away. The only tension on April 20th came from excessive support. A dozen members of the new Black Panther Party marched, in the military sense, into Freedom Plaza. They were dressed in black fatigues, black motorcycle helmets, and combat boots. They scowled and did drill maneuvers about facing and attentioning. The new Black Panthers carried pictures of Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. Their picket signs were professionally printed. "The State of Israel has no right to exist. The American-Israeli white man is the devil. Jihad." They hollered, "Death to Israel. Holy war, holy war, holy war," and "Kill every Zionist in Palestine." For a moment, the other demonstrators were silent. They fidgeted. They backed away. "Excuse me, I'm so sorry," said a courteous Arab-American teenager who stepped on my foot. Then a chant began in the crowd. "Killing is not the answer. Killing is not the answer." The chant grew louder. Demonstrators raised their fingers in peace signs and began to press in on the new Black Panther Party. Cacophonous drumming came from the global justice mobilizers. They shouted, "No more hate!" A woman about my own age began screaming into a bullhorn, "Jews and Arabs, unite!" The new Black Panther Party, with somewhat less military elan than before, marched away. As it happened, the old Black Panther Party was holding its 35th reunion that weekend at the University of the District of Columbia. Former chairman of the party, Bobby Seale, attended. "I like the methodical way it was done," he was quoted as saying about the war in Afghanistan. "That's how you judge the operation when you're dealing with a bunch of terrorists, such as they are." The crowd in Freedom Plaza grew and pressed against the front of the National Theater. Emerging patrons were trapped beneath the marquee. A pair of older women stood patiently, staring at the protesters. "I gather you're not a part of the demonstration," I said.
"No," said one woman. "We came to see a matinee of Mamma Mia."
"But all of America is part of this turmoil," the other woman said. "How are you going to get out of here?" I asked.
"We'll just go back in," said the first woman, "and see another show."
The Columbia mobilization joined the Answer rally on the Ellipse, and thousands more protesters pushed toward Freedom Plaza. They looked familiar. If I took off my bifocals, they could have been the same denim-pantsed, T-shirted, funny-coiffed, oddly-shod, beard-attempting kids with whom I had protested at this very place a generation ago. It was a startling continuity in youthful fashion, as if I had arrived at my anti-Vietnam War protest in Washington in 1970 and found everyone wearing zoot suits. One thing, however, had changed in 32 years. Regular folks felt no desire to kick these young people for the way they looked. The kids were so thoroughly tattooed and body pierced that whatever pain someone might want to inflict on them, they had already inflicted it on themselves. One bunch began a skit involving a boy in a Halloween skull mask spraying an aerosol can at girls carrying primitive paintings that depicted agricultural endeavors. Then they all dropped dead and yelled something about Columbia. The marchers trampled the grass on the Ellipse. "More gardens," a sign read. Other posters and banners declared, "Give communism a chance. Peace is patriotic. End Ashcroft's police state. Republicans for peace and justice for all. Stop calling Palestinians terrorists. Real profits from peace. Corporations are killing the world. The U.S. started it all. Down with Algerian fascist regime. Peace treaty in Korea. Leave Chavez alone and focus your discontent."
Indeed. Many of the signs were wordy.
"AIDS treatment now. Coke's neglect equals death for workers in South Africa." Another began, "Bush's Pax Americana made us the axis of ignorance and a global stupid power. Thanks, W."
And continued in that vein. Some signs were touchingly simple. "Please stop killing everybody." Others had an air of hopelessness. "The only weapon a terrorist needs is purpose. Their purpose grows with each day of the war on terror." One sign, I think, misspoke itself. "Goliath lost." David, after all, was an Israeli. The middle-aged Vermonters for Peace looked like they gave themselves their own haircuts. A young lady handed me a square of poster board washed in pink watercolor with a brighter pink star painted on it and "Peace" painstakingly lettered across the front. A family displayed a photograph of Afghan women labeled "Our Afghan Sister Family." They gave me a printed handout stating that the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan had condemned the U.S.-backed Northern Alliance for a record of human rights violations as bad as that of the Taliban's. The handout ended with the sad and deflated sentence, "This statement has apparently been ignored by George Bush and his associates." A young man wore a T-shirt saying, "I used to be a white American, but I gave it up in the interest of humanity." But another demonstrator wore one of the Abercrombie and Fitch T-shirts that recently had been withdrawn from stores following accusations of racial insensitivity. A fat, slant-eyed bodhisattva appeared above the slogan, "Get your Buddha on the floor." Nearby was a banner from the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. The four rallies had now joined together, a total of about 75,000 people. They trooped down Pennsylvania Avenue toward the mall with the Palestinian Solidarity marchers in the lead. Many young Arab-American women had cell phones pressed to their headscarves and were saying things like, "You wouldn't believe it, I'm right here on the mall." Scores of Palestinian flags and a variety of flags from other Arab nations were being waved. "What's that flag?" asked another co-ed being interviewed by Max.
"Lebanon," Max said.
"But why are they waving a flag from Lebanon?" she said.
In among the Arab-American families, some of whom had brought coolers and lawn chairs, were college students with a sign reading, "If queer soldiers undermine the military, sign us up." An exhausted-looking teenager wearing anarchist symbols sat on a curb with a piece of cardboard on which he had lettered, "Burn me, I'm old and in the way." Appearing without intended irony, near the scores of charter buses that had been hired by the demonstrators was, "Visualize fuel-efficient vehicles. It's a national security."